Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back with another of our string of weather-related episodes here. And I'm excited about this because we really have landed on quite a few good resources and experts to bring into the show for a variety of weather-related topics. And we'll get into who's the guests on the show tonight. But first off, we've got to bring in our primary guest, and not really a guest, but actually the co-host of the show, Sam Bradley.
Hey, thank you, Jamie. No problem. Well, strangely, last week we were concerned about whether your electricity would stay on because you had a storm going on there. And even as I speak, we have one landing here, another nice thunderstorm, and my idiot neighbor is out there mowing his lawn. Maybe we should have a chat about that. But I have to tell you, too, and maybe Kyle has a picture of it, but he sent me a picture of this vehicle. You know how I feel about hail. This picture of this vehicle that somebody had taken cardboard boxes and taped to the entire vehicle. There's your hail protection. I thought, you know, that's not a bad idea. Yeah, maybe I should, do that. But anyway, yes, we are talking weather again tonight. We're going to make weather junkies out of all of our listeners, I think, like they have us. he's already popped it up. So in general, Mr. Kyle, let's talk a bit about what's going on in the weather in general.
Well, hey, Sam, and good evening to everyone on the Disaster Podcast. Meteorologist Kyle Nelson here. Looking back over the past week, it's been a pretty active week of things with regard to weather, both above and below the ground, I guess. To our friends in Hawaii, still pretty active on the volcano side of things with Kilauea and all those surrounding areas. Really, biggest things that I was able to pull together on this one is that with all some of the new eruptions, the new fissures continuing to open, still emitting a lot of volcanic gases as well as a lot of ash. So staying tuned to those local officials and for those evacuation notices and things like that. If you're looking for the latest observations and what's going on there, the U.S. Geologic Survey is definitely the one to follow there. Jamie, quick question on volcanoes.
Yeah, you know, it's right after our call last week, we had a... some more information came in as the volcano and the lava was reaching the sea and causing additional problems with the steam that comes off of that and the salts in the salt water converting into hydrochloric acid and carrying particulates of glass into the air with it, making it extremely toxic and hard to breathe. Then on top of that, this week, I actually saw a news segment on a guy who's trying to save his house. He's about 500 yards from one of the open fissures that's very actively erupting. And he's standing there with three fire extinguishers and a garden hose to put out the lava bombs that are landing on and around his house.
Oh my God.
Like, there's like multiple holes in his roof where it's come, these football sized pieces of lava have come crashing into his home, and he races over and puts them out. And it just made me think of, you know, there's a certain point where you just have to, you know, say it's a losing cause. He says that you can dodge them because you can see them coming because they kind of lob gracefully through the air like a football, except it's a football you don't want to catch. People really need to pay attention to the evacuation warnings, don't they?
Absolutely, they do. Heeding those alerts and advisories from your local officials and taking heed because absolutely not a football that we want to catch or definitely not something we want to be trying to fight ourselves. Switching topics now to kind of the flip side of things, heavy rain and flooding across Virginia and North Carolina. At least one person unfortunately confirmed dead after flash flooding triggered a mudslide in North Carolina. Several states of emergency have been declared, and multiple roads in the mid-Atlantic have been washed out or flooded by heavy rains. That flooding is expected to continue for several days because of all the runoff out of the mountainous areas into the lower-lying spots. And, of course, Florida now and much of the southeast under the watchful eye of the National Weather Service for mostly flooding rains that were focused on here across the peninsula and panhandle of Florida and across the southeast with this latest tropical system, potential tropical system working its way up out of the Gulf of Mexico. I do want to finally make mention, along with our topic for today's podcast, of two very sobering anniversaries this week. It's been 5 years since the May 20, 2013, Moore, Oklahoma tornado that killed 24, including 7 children at the Plaza Towers Elementary School, and 7 years since the, actually as we're recording here, May 22nd, 2011, Joplin, Missouri EF5 that killed over 160. Those lives lost, they were not in vain. Many lessons were learned. We've progressed greatly as a weather and emergency management and first response enterprise. And it's, you know, a topic that we can really talk about and continue to carry forward, especially tonight on this episode here.
Wow, that's a lot of good information, and it's a good segue to what we're going to be talking about tonight. And we have our other meteorologist, who is, if you listen closely, you'll hear from her in the next couple of podcasts, and we loved having her so much, we actually brought her back tonight, and that's Becky DePodwin, our AccuWeather meteorologist. I got to know, Becky, how much do you guys talk about lava and such in AccuWeather? Where'd she go? Hello?
Sorry, I had myself muted and forgot to unmute myself.
That's a rookie mistake.
Rookie mistake.
We do it all the time.
And I said, more than you think. I was actually asked today if I knew something about lava flows. And I was like, well, I could read some things and learn about it, but I'm not an expert. But we've been doing some coverage. We actually have one of our guys, Jonathan Petromala, who's actually out reporting live from Hawaii. So it's definitely news. We definitely care about it.
Yeah, and I got to ask you one other thing before we go to Chris. You mentioned the 10 years since the Windsor tornado. Windsor is 10 miles from me. I don't remember ever having heard about that one. Would you care to elucidate?
Yeah, so it was in 2008, May 22nd. It was the end of my freshman year of college at UNC in Greeley, and I was out chasing in Kansas that day. The tornado started down in Platteville. It was on the ground for 39 miles, tracked northwest towards the mountains at about noon. It was pretty early in the day. It went through part of my hometown of Windsor, caused a lot of destruction. It was rated an EF3. At one point, it was 3/4 of a mile wide and produced a lot of significant hail damage as well. It did cost one person their life. But that, for me, that was the tornado that really hit home, literally, personally.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's an anniversary. It seems like May 22nd, May 20th. It's just really a hot date for bad tornadoes.
Yeah, well, as I'm sitting here in the thunderstorm.
Well, this is really the height of the tornado season we're in right now, correct?
Yeah, it is.
Lovely. Just lovely. Well, speaking of Tornado Central, we have our friend Chris Putzman, who's been with us, even though it's been a while. And he is dead center in the middle of that in Oklahoma. Chris, do you still live in Moore? Or I believe you did, didn't you?
I do live in Moore. I live on the southeast side of Moore, and I'm very familiar with all of the dates that have been aforementioned.
Are you crazy? That is probably the last place in the world I would be brave enough to live, given all the tornado activity there. But I know you're a little crazy, so that's okay. So, Chris, tell folks about yourself and what you do, and we'll talk a little tornado here.
Well, currently I am the director of operations for a company by the name of Samaritan EMS. We are a provider of 911 and non-emergency transport services for several municipalities in Oklahoma. We also operate a military contract for EMS response on Tinker Air Force Base, and we provide ground services for the OU Medical Systems NICU transport team, which services the state of Oklahoma with obviously critical care, neonatal transport. I also have a role at Tinker Air Force Base on their incident management team as one of the medical branch leaders. And recently was asked to become a medical advisor for a local SWAT team. So that's my latest project, which I'm very excited about.
Oh, yeah, that sounds pretty cool. Well, for those of you that don't know, Chris and I go way back. I taught him to be an EMT, and he taught me to be a scuba diver, and it worked out good for both of us. But tell them what happened when you landed in, when you moved to Oklahoma to be a medic.
Well, when I moved, relocated to Oklahoma, I was actually working for American Medical Response, which was the subcontractor for the Emergency Medical Service Authority, or EMSA, which is known across the country as one of the remaining public utility models, and AMR was their contractor. And I landed here, and the first spring that I was here, we had the May 3rd event, which I'm sure my colleagues on the podcast from the meteorology side of the house remember that storm. That was a rather large mile-wide F5 tornado. And at that point in time, obviously, I was working as a full-time paramedic. That, again, storm did strike more. And the really interesting thing about it was, if you follow the show Paramedics, they were here in town for a month. And for Oklahoma City, they had a really mundane, kind of non-eventful month, you know, very normal EMS calls and not a lot of, you know, great footage, if you will, for a TV program. And a gentleman by the name of Tony McCarty, who has been an icon in the EMSA system and remains such, was watching the weather and was basically telling him, maybe you want to hang around one more day. And that hanging around one more day turned into the Force 5 episode, which I believe was actually 2-hour-long episodes, and really kind of introduced the world to what a tornado can actually do. My responsibility in that response is I actually ended up on the north side in the city of Moore, on the north side of the damage path, and we ended up setting up a casualty collection point, and we're shipping folks out from there. But there's a scene in the show where there's a female and male paramedic team, and they were about 300 yards south of me, but I never knew they were there because the rubble pile was so large. No, we couldn't see each other. So that was kind of my first indoctrination to storm season. I would, from the response side and the experience side, I'd recommend it for anybody. From a person living in the community, it's probably one of the most devastating things you'll ever experience.
Well, I remember that episode, and I was very impressed with it. That's before I even realized you were involved in it. Oh, good. Kyle put the link up. But I remember that one guy was sent to, I think, a school gym, and he's basically there by himself, and all of these people were coming in, all these critical patients, and the guy just, you know, he really did the best he could. I had to give him kudos on that.
It's, yeah, he had like one tank of oxygen from his ambulance, and cardiac patients coming in that were experiencing chest pain. He was really swamped, and it became a system resources management, you know, problem for him to deal with, rather than really a medical care problem.
Yeah, and on top of that, he's got cameras looking at him.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. That gentleman actually is a physician now. He went on to medical school and was very successful as a physician. But I don't remember the gentleman's last name. His first name was Steve, and hopefully it will come back to me as we talk about it. But he was actually sent to a community southwest of Oklahoma City by the name of Bridge Creek. And Bridge Creek was a little rural town that was basically totally annihilated by that tornado. And he was in the high school gym with no power, no water. He was the only responding unit that was there. And that's not an area that we would normally cover. They actually picked up somebody at a kind of law enforcement kind of barricade point that kind of knew the area and got them in there. And there was obviously some local fire department folks that were helping out and some local healthcare providers that obviously couldn't leave the community. So he basically set up his triage and his treatment area in that gym and probably spent about 3 hours there without any help at all. What a tremendous job he did, and obviously for the world to see. So kudos to him. And obviously that also launched EMS in Oklahoma really into the incident command system. We didn't have that really well flushed out before that particular event. And that kind of spurred that whole movement on here. So there was a lot of good that came out of that unfortunate event.
Well, and I remember the two people on the ambulance that were kind of stuck where they were because of debris in the road. And basically, they became a mini ER. They just opened the doors and people came to them and they treated what they could. And then I remember them stopping passing trucks and saying, hey, transport this guy. So they too, I mean, EMS has got to be really creative in these situations. And all of those people who didn't see this coming did such a fantastic job. And Jamie made the comment that he's watched it several times just to learn from it. Right, Jamie?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a, you know, when you're a paramedic and you're working and you don't run into these types of major events, you know, maybe ever in your career, but maybe you have to plan and prepare for it nonetheless, you start watching these things going, what would I do if? And I think that that's a good exercise to put your brain through. So I watched these episodes when they were first coming out on television. I actually recorded them on a VHS tape and watched them many times over the next couple of years periodically, just to kind of put my brain into that mode and say, what would I do if this happened in my community? What would I do if I was at the local high school gymnasium and it was just me and a chase vehicle with whatever supplies I had on board? How would I manage 50 patients? And I think it's a good exercise to put yourself through. And Chris, you can probably talk about this, you know, the kind of that personal sand table event, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Well, I was just saying, you know, that you know, individual paramedics, maybe your system doesn't do major training or preparatory events, but you can still, as an individual professional, go through a kind of a mental exercise when you think about these types of things of how you would respond.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's an essential skill for any EMS provider is the mental exercises of the what ifs. And in these large scale events, you know, you are sometimes on an island for a little while and what am I going to do? And I think you have to really shift gears to do the most good for the most people and understand that the situation is at some points in time very grave and that there is there's going to be some folks that we just can't do a lot for. And I think that there's a lot of education and training that goes on in our business to save lives, but we don't really touch a lot on these rather large incidents where we've got this kind of the situation where we may not be able to help them all. And fortunately for me in my career, I've dealt with these types of incidents here in Oklahoma several times. And I guess that prepares me for the next big one because eventually there will be another big one. But for those that are venturing out, I would definitely recommend exactly what you just said, kind of a, if I'm stuck in this position, what exactly do I do? So.
Was that Steve Finley that you were talking about?
Steve
Chris?
Finley. That
yeah,
is correct.
Kyle came up with that one. I guess he knows it too. But Becky, you made a comment on a little factoid about this tornado. You want to mention that?
If I'm correct in that he was, well, there are two tornadoes. I'm not sure which he was referring to because Moore has been hit with two EF5s now. But the one on May 3rd, 1999, still holds the record for the fastest wind speed ever recorded in a tornado. And it's referred to as the Bridge Creek Moore tornado. And actually, one of my professors that taught me in college was chasing that day and witnessed that tornado.
Wow.
I could find the wind speed.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know what that was. Maybe you can find
it. Over 311 miles an hour.
Yeah, it's over 300.
So what is the top end of an F5? When would it go to an F6, even though nobody's seen one of those yet?
There technically is no top end. It's anything greater than I'm like totally failing me right now.
Kyle can over jump in and save you.
300. This is what happens when you're tired. EF5 is I think over 200 actually.
To 300. Right. And remembering that these numbers, the EF or the you know, back before the changes made, the F scale ratings are assigned after the fact. With these tornadoes. So it's based on observed damage, which is, it's a limitation of the system, right? So if you have this big, large, very destructive tornado impacting structures and the built environment, we can observe and evaluate the damage as scientists and infer what range of wind speeds may have caused the damage, then assign an EF number to classify it. Where if it moves through an empty field, it's very difficult to assign the number, even though it's it appears very large visually, and we cannot yet do that in real time. So if you hear a meteorologist or someone talking, oh, that has to be at least an EF3 or that's at least an EF4, that's purely speculation. We are not that advanced in the science yet to be able to assign those things in real time.
Well, I know they're all dangerous. Well, Chris, you had one go by your house here just recently, didn't you? It wasn't an F5, but you were...
Yeah, we had a small one, an F0, F1 that kind of popped up. We haven't had a very active storm season in Oklahoma the past 2 years, so it's kind of given a lot of excitement when we actually do get something going that there's a whole meteorology television response, and they like to exercise and do all their good stuff, and they've got some really cool equipment that they like to show off, which is awesome. But we had one that kind of popped out of a storm, and our meteorology colleagues will probably understand the term bowed out. The storm was bowed out, and for whatever reason, it just decided in this little spot it was going to spin a little one up, and it just cruised by the house. We kind of watched it go by right at sunset. It was a romantic moment, and then we went on about our day, so... It just kind of happens here in Oklahoma.
Oklahoma romance.
Yeah, I'm just pretty normal everyday stuff for you guys anyway.
Your eyes look beautiful in the light of the reflection of the tornado.
I was going to ask Kyle a question, and now you completely
respond. I'm sorry.
he does that sometimes. Kyle, there was something about Connecticut. They called it an outbreak, and I know you don't like that term, but is Connecticut someplace we usually see this, or is this an anomaly?
Well, Sam, any state in the union has, every state in the union has experienced tornadoes. So everyone, every state has had at least one. And Connecticut and the Northeast, typically not what you would think of when you think of a very active tornado region. So, well, they may not be as common as, say, out on the plain states or down in the southeast. That, you know, we can translate that also into kind of a level of awareness and preparedness where you talk to someone from Texas, from Arkansas, from Louisiana, or northern Mississippi or Alabama, they can tell you about tornadoes all day and how they're prepared, where in the Northeast, where they're less frequent, there's a lot of optimism to say, oh, those don't occur here. Oh, they don't occur very much at all, so I don't have to think about it. And it's something that we absolutely do have to think about, because when the conditions come together, they can occur any time of year.
Well, and I think the kind of the point to this whole conversation is be prepared for anything, because anything can happen. I don't know, Chris, are there any volcanoes in Oklahoma?
Well, we're kind of waiting to see. We now obviously have added earthquakes to our repertoire, so maybe there could be a volcano here somewhere one of these days. I mean, I'm waiting for the return of the dinosaurs as well, so it's an evolving situation, I'm sure.
yeah, nothing would surprise you at this point in Oklahoma. But I got to ask, we were talking earlier, you know, about, I think Kyle posed the question, how much do your EMS people train for this kind of thing, this mass MCI, if you will, and how do you prepare as a community? We've had a lot of interest in that from our listeners as far as community preparedness for any kind of event, basically.
Well, from the response standpoint, obviously after that May 3rd event, as I mentioned, we kind of really got engrossed in the incident management system and kind of reached out to our fire and police colleagues and built the metropolitan medical response system and the regional medical response systems after that event. And the nice thing about Oklahoma is that particular, there's one particular person that heads up both of those divisions, if you will. And the Oklahoma standard, as you guys, I'm sure, have heard from the Oklahoma City bombing, is still very much alive and well. And that kind of flows through the emergency medical system, whether it's EMS or the hospitals. And it's a very well-coordinated and well-informed kind of system. We are also blessed to have the National Weather Service right down here in Norman, just south of me, about 6 miles, that does a lot of outreach and a lot of education to the community. Prime example, you cannot build a new house in the city of Moore, Oklahoma, without a tornado shelter, for obvious reasons. But they really reach out about preparedness and how to organize your shelter. And if you don't have a shelter, where you can go, and just how to keep the family together. That was one of the biggest challenges. We mentioned the May 20th storm. That storm rolled through right at the end of the school day. So thank God the kids weren't home, because there was a lot of homes that were taken in that. And obviously the tragedy at that elementary school. But there was no plan in place for the school to communicate what we were doing with the kids and those types of things. And there was a lot of trepidation there for a while about what happened to the children, and where are we going to go, and where are they at? And so that again bolstered a program to be put together. So they do a really good job here of staying weather aware, and a really good job of continually reinforcing those fundamental points of preparedness.
Oh, excellent. Jamie, how about your area?
Well, we get a tornado here in central Maryland or northeastern Maryland, probably, I'd say, maybe once a year in the state, maybe a little more frequently. And Becky might be able to pull up some numbers. I know eastern Pennsylvania gets some occasionally as well. They seem to be rather short-lived. They cause from my experience here in this area, localized damage, where, we see trees twisted and ripped apart, roofs of homes taken off. The injuries or deaths that have occurred usually happen as a result of trees falling on homes or trailer homes. Because a lot, it's a hilly area. I think some of that protects the people down in the hollows or the low areas, but then the trees still fall and can cause injury or death.
Wow, Becky just brought up an interesting sight about two tornadoes hitting Maryland in 2 weeks. Want to talk about that, Becky?
Yeah, so that was last year. This article, and maybe we can link to it in show notes, I'm not sure, but it talks about the tornado activity in kind of the D.C. area and up to Salisbury, Maryland, and just the average tornado by month that comes within 100 miles of that city center. And interestingly enough, the month with the most tornadoes is July, and the average is just above 6 for Washington, D.C. Keep in mind that's 100 miles from within the center of the city of Washington, D.C. So I think they actually happen a little more often than you think. My guess is that they're generally on the weekend, usually EF0, EF1, EF2. Yes, these tornadoes were almost all short-lived in weeks. 7 of 8 were rated EF0. So they're not usually very strong, but they do definitely occur fairly often.
Wow, you're almost as good as Jamie as far as bringing up good stuff while we're podcasting. He's a master at that. So, Kyle, you both probably know, having been or are Coloradans like me. But, Kyle, what do you know about Colorado's preparedness? Is that kind of dependent on the area or what?
Well, Sam, several factors kind of influence preparedness in Colorado. And kind of to tackle it from one kind of standpoint first is we have a lot of transplants. So that's folks that have come into Colorado from areas outside of the state. And they may not be familiar with the particular hazards that Colorado has. The Front Range, Denver area, and Colorado Springs and such, those areas are growing and just exploding with population. And you're kind of then making, a larger sprawling city kind of a bigger target for, tornadoes and things out there. As far as tornado preparedness goes, kind of the feeling and some of the misconceptions there is that, tornadoes don't occur in the mountains because, they're in the mountains. They can't go over mountains. They won't go over rivers. The interstates or, nothing can occur west of I-25 type of deal across along the Front Range. But we've seen several cases of where that happens. And some of the biggest tornadoes typically, they'll occur more in either east central or east of I-25, where you have all those ingredients for tornadoes come together. And we're fortunate where we can see the tornadoes quite well most often, because the storms, because we're so high in elevation, don't produce a lot of precipitation like rain and hail. So we can see them much more easily from a distance. But that's not always the case in some areas of the country. So people are definitely aware of it, but education is always needed and is always ongoing.
Wow. I know we got to wind down here, but Jamie, you and I both live in a rural environment. How do you think, this is just a question, but how do you think preparedness changes from the, or is handled differently in a rural versus a urban setting?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, we're in an area where most of the response is handled by either combination volunteer paid services or entirely volunteer services. And so it's a lot of neighbor helping neighbor. And it's interesting because in my experience with any kind of disaster response, we tend to just dig ourselves out. It happened when we had the major snowstorms in years past, where we ended up with close to 4 feet of snow on the ground and most of the roads were clogged shut. You know, farmers got out with their front end loaders and tractors and started digging out because they needed to get their milk out from the dairy farms, and neighbors started digging neighbors out. And when an ambulance needed to get in somewhere and the snow plow couldn't get in, you know, the farmers would stop what they were doing and go dig out that road so that they could get their neighbor to the hospital. And, you know, it's just a different, you know, it's a different kind of resilience in a rural area, simply because people often have this type of equipment readily available that you wouldn't necessarily have in an urban or even suburban environment. So it's a little bit different. We're a little more spread out too, which means that we're not as close to necessary resources. And in a major injury or a major medical event happens, those outcomes can sometimes be negatively affected by that. So, you know, you take the good with the bad. But I like where I live. I like the people I live near. And I think, well, Becky, you're up there in State College, so you've got rural areas all around you that are probably very similar.
Yeah, it's definitely something that I think all the EMs have to keep in mind. We have a lot of county emergency management. And I one of my professors actually is in Lancaster, and he's spoken a lot about how they have to incorporate the Amish into their emergency plan, which is difficult because the Amish don't have cell phones. They don't have any kind of electronics most of the time. So how do they receive warnings? How are they notified about storms? So that's just something that they have to keep in mind when it comes to being prepared and up to date for severe weather.
You know, it's interesting. We have several fire companies because we're right up against Lancaster County here in Maryland. And we have several local fire departments that act in mutual aid with our company that have Amish members, significant numbers of Amish that are members of the volunteer fire company. And I'll tell you what, you can't have a better group of people to be at your back and working at your side. They put in, they work a lot harder and last a lot longer than I do, that's for sure.
Yeah. It's also talked about how resilient they are, how, you know, a barn or something will be destroyed and the next day they're out there and it's already halfway built back up.
Definitely.
Wow. Yeah, very good at that. So finally, Chris, I don't know much about the community you currently live in, but, you know, what's your community preparedness like?
Well, more obviously has been through this twice on the total rebuild side. So they are keenly aware of what absolutely can happen. And it's a very tight-knit community, obviously, that's been through a lot. So there, we are very weather aware just in the city of Moore, but obviously in the Metroplex of Oklahoma City, and really, you know, kind of the state. It's, as Jamie had mentioned, we band together and take care of business. And, that's one of the reasons why I really enjoy living here is for that reason. But, Moore has, done a lot to prepare and protect. We've just finished a project, a bond project to put, what they call mass storm shelters in all of the elementary schools. So the new schools get built with basically safe hallways in the bottoms of the schools, and the new or the older schools have been retrofitted with basically a massive safe room to ensure that we don't have the situation that we had on May 20th again. And that's kind of, you know, been the movement through the state. It's obviously finding the funding to make that happen. But it's a pleasure doing business with the emergency responders in the city of Moore. I get to work with them collaboratively and around the state. They're very professional and very prepared.
Nice to know. Any final thoughts, words of wisdom, Kyle?
Yeah, Sam. I think we kind of can reflect back on a lot of this conversation and some of our previous podcast discussions with, you know, preparing for not just tornadoes, but any hazard is having, you know, a system in place, you know, using the incident command system, knowing what it is, what your role is, and how you fit into that picture. And cross-training with partner agencies, from teaching weather safety and preparedness nationwide, that's the biggest thing that everyone comes back to. Teaching about tornadoes down in the Southeast this week, and it's just incredible. And you ask, you know, how have you gotten through these very destructive events? And they say, we cross-train, we work with our partners, and we don't have a specific plan like for tornadoes or just hurricanes for mass casualty or the medical response side. You can apply those same concepts and just be open to learning from other events and training from.
Did we lose Kyle?
Specific. Wow. So be open-minded.
Kyle, you dropped
and
out
learn.
For just a second
no,
there.
No, there he is.
Sorry, Jamie.
That's okay.
So
just
yeah,
wrap
no,
up.
Just, yeah, no, just to recap, be flexible, be open to new ideas. And if you want to know about plans, you want to learn more, reach out to folks like Chris and ask. They will point you in the right direction.
Absolutely. Good points, Kyle. Any final thoughts, Becky?
Just understand your threat and your risk, what you might be facing in your area, whether it's tornadoes, hurricanes, blizzards, and have a plan in place for all of those. You know where you're going to meet your family should you get separated. Have a to-go bag if you need to evacuate. Know your evacuation routes. Just take it upon yourself as a citizen to be as prepared as possible for whatever you may face.
Wow. Well, I know I've learned some things tonight, Jamie. Why don't you take us out?
Well, you know, I think that this is a perfect segue to kind of jump into the different things. And Kyle talked about cross-training. Becky talked about being prepared at an individual level. All of those things are important for responders and emergency managers to do. You can't be responding for your community if you don't know your family is prepared and safe. You can't respond effectively with your community if you aren't cross-training with neighboring communities and other agencies within your community. All these things are important, and they come down to training and having good resources to do that. And I always like to bring this back to our sponsors, Paragon Medical Education Group, Joe Holly, Jim Logan, the rest of the team there. They are all experienced responders to disaster events of various types. They bring in other people who have responded to things like the Joplin event, Joplin tornado. They bring in people that have experienced responding to earthquake events, mass casualty injuries from active shooter incidents. All of these things they bring these individuals to your system and provide you specific customized training on whatever topic you want to deal with. And as Becky said, being aware of what you can expect to see in your community will help you understand what you need to start training with first and then build down from there to the less frequent expected events. They're available. Head over and check them out at ParagonMedicalGroup.com. You can find them on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU. And don't forget to also find them linked either on our podcast site at DisasterPodcast.com or on our Facebook group, which you can find over at Facebook by searching for Disaster Podcast. And they're very responsive, and they'd love to just chat with you and find out what their system, what your system needs and what they can do to bring something cost-effective and reasonable to your system to help your people be better prepared. So I think it's time to wrap up. Chris, is there a place where you're available for people to check in with you if they want to say, hey, you know, can you talk to us a little bit about community resilience, or can you help us out with where to get started?
I have a personal Facebook page. You can look me up at Chris, C-H-R-I-S, Prutzman, P as in Peter, R-U, T as in Tom, Z as in Zebra, M-A-N. Also, our corporation website, SamaritanEMSOK.com. You can just reach out via personal message, and I'll be glad to answer anything I can.
And thank you, Chris, for coming on again. You've been a pretty regular guest here on the show several times a year, and we really appreciate you bringing your expertise to bear and share it with our community.
Thank you so much for having me.
Becky, where can folks find you? This is your third time on the show. It's great to have you back so soon. And maybe people would like to reach out and find out more about the types of resources you have, as well as your podcasts.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on again. It's a lot of fun. I host two podcasts. One is In the Elements. That is at Elements Pod on Twitter. The second is iStation Houseman at iStation Houseman on Twitter. And if you want to reach me directly, I am at WX_Bex, or search Becky D. Podwin, just like it sounds. I'm the only one out there, and I'm happy to talk about anything, weather, emergency management, crisis communication, mental health, that anybody wants to talk to.
Awesome. And it's great to have you as a resource as well for our community here. So folks, take advantage and check out Becky's podcast while you're at it. Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. I'm always happy to continue the conversation.
Thank you. And Sam?
I'll be right there with Kyle on social media under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 on our Facebook page, of course. And please come by there and ask some questions. We have a lot of folks ready there to answer them. And on the disasterpodcast.com website. What about you, Jamie?
Well, under the handle PodMedic in most social media channels out there, so please friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with me there. And again, on the Disaster Podcast site or over on our Facebook group, look it up, ask to join the group. We'd love to have you in there. It's a great place to ask questions on the individual episodes. We often have our guests in the group as well, or we can direct them to you and they can leave a direct response to your questions. So please take an opportunity to come in there and check it out and join the community over there. We've got 612 members, I think, so far in that group. It's a nice sized group of people that are in all levels of emergency response, from individuals in the community all the way up to ER docs, emergency managers, and disaster responders of all types and sizes. Sam, you know, we've talked about a lot of things: community resilience, community preparedness for tornadoes, but these things really translate out to all sorts of weather events.
Absolutely. And I have to mention, too, we have a lot of folks. Oh, hang on here. Sorry about that. Something just distracted me. But I wanted to mention, too, that we have a lot of folks from different countries, and it's great to hear from them and what they're learning from us. And I'd like to grab some of them sometime and find out how things work in the country. So maybe we can reach out and do that sometime. But, you know, my alternate tagline fits here. Emergency weather, disaster weather, is not our everyday weather.